So I'm here with Ian Lee, who is most recently the author of Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
It's a pleasure to chat with someone who's from the Bay Area. I do miss the Bay Area. I was from there myself. So.
I know, yeah. It's a nice place to live.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and cut straight to the chase here. I wanted to talk about a few aspects of your work. The death of the anti-revolutionary in The Vagrants. The unclear impact of the blogger's actions in a man like him. It's often argued that conflict generally emerges from tangible conflicts or objects. I mean, Chekhov's gun, just to use a very obvious one. But it seems to me that in your work, your conflict tends to come from invisible, vacant scenarios, like loss or, death, disappearance, disgrace. I'm wondering why so much of your consequential action jumps from that.
You know, that's a very good question. I'm not sure I need to think, but I think the way I look at fiction is, you know, the most dramatic moments the most dramatic moments do not come from physical or real dramas, but from internal dramas.
Yeah.
And those moments actually are quite still. If you look from outside,
yeah.
And those are the moments I like to write about in fiction.
I'm wondering why narrative scenarios or stories tend to come more from that than, say, a natural collision of ideas or a natural collision of two characters, like, you know, arguing in a coffee shop or something.
Right. I think with that scenario, you know, if you have two characters or two ideas bumping into each other, there's no space for them to stop. You know, it's like a train wreck. It's like a crash. You just, as a writer, you have to follow that, which is, you know, some writers do really well following that crash. By nature, I don't think I follow that crash, but I like the aftermath of the crash or the right before that crash. So I don't follow the event. I follow the crash within the crash, in a way. Yeah.
Do you feel that if you had, say, an obvious crash, like two people, that this might complicate a narrative situation that you're forming in your head or something like that? Does you work better with a kind of, from a minimalist narrative scenario than, say, a rather complex one?
Yes, I think, you know, in a way, I think my fiction doesn't deal with a lot of, you know, physical actions. I think maybe that reflects my tendency to back up a little, just to watch. And when I watch, my attention oftentimes is not with the real, I mean, not real, with the physical, like, crash or, you know, noise. I'm very sensitive to noises. And I think those moments, they're sometimes it's too much noise. It's too noisy for me. So I would go away and I would go into the internal world where the noise, it's a different kind of noise.
Have any sentences or any character developments emerged in your head from a noise? I'm curious.
Oh, that's so funny. No, I think oftentimes that the characters start with a very quiet moment. I don't think I have... Oh, I would say, you know, the counter-revolutionary who was sentenced to death in The Vagrants, she was the only one of my characters, I think, that had a little bit of noises in her.
Yeah.
And her experience was quite noisy and loud, so she was the only one.
I mean, this is very interesting because I actually wanted to remark upon one thing I've observed in your work. You have a very slight internal rhyme to many of your sentences, and I'm going to actually dig out some examples here to show you I'm not like some paranoid, crazy freak here. Spring in Beijing was as brief as a young girl's grief over a bad haircut. That's in No. 3 Garden Road. In House Fire, the courts as the last resort. In Kindness, I fumbled under the bundled clothes. Not exact, but close enough. I mean, you mentioned sound. I'm curious how rhyme along these lines helps to anchor a sentence for you. How a sentence is formed based off of this rhythm. Because there is this really, you know, wonderful rhythm, I think, particularly. And it comes out more directly to the reader, I think, with the internal rhyme.
Right. So the question is somewhat about how do I come up with these sentences?
Yes. Or it's how has this musicality come about?
Right. Yeah. I think one thing is I have to write to the music. I actually imagine the music of my stories.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one thing that's really important. I'm not a visual writer, so I don't imagine the images. I imagine the rhythm and the tone. So So in a way, I think you just have to push the sentence to match to the music in your head.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you literally have a song going on.
Yeah.
There's a musical phrase right there. You have to get the sentence matching up exactly, even
right.
if it's diatonic. Or
right. It's almost like the sentence has to talk to the music in my head rather than anything else, I think.
Is this why it takes you so long to often come up with a sentence or a story, because you're so exact like that?
I am. I think I do pay a lot of attention to the sentences. And I also listen to music. Like, sometimes I would choose a specific piece that I think would match the mood of the story or to the novel. I would listen to it again and again, thank you very much, until I get it. The sentence and the music, they sort of have that conversation.
Did you want to eat?
Eat it later.
Okay. All right. So I'm curious what kind of music is going on in your head, because are we talking the Ramones? Are we talking classical music?
Well, this is a little confession. My first book was written to U2.
Oh, yeah?
I was listening to U2 songs.
Which albums?
Actually, all the albums at the time. You know what? My husband would make all these files and on my computers, I would have all the U2 songs, and I would just go over and over again while I listened to U2. I would write. That's how my first collection came into being. But then I think that music has changed since then. Now it's more classic music. I listen to Tchaikovsky a lot, because I feel very close to his music, and Brahms is oftentimes my accompanying pieces. And Mahler. I wrote one story, Kindness, the novella, in the new collection, completely to Mahler's Symphony No. 1.
Yeah. Which Tchaikovsky? The 1812 Overture?
1812, yes.
I knew it. That's so fitting in light of the sort of oppressed nature of the characters.
Yes. Tchaikovsky is really close to my mind, I think. Yeah. I don't know. His music moves me just beyond words.
I'm curious if you have thought to find composers or artists who have been, you know, oppressed in some ways, as Tchaikovsky was, you know?
No.
Okay. You know, speaking of oppression, this is a good segue into something I've been really curious about. I mean, in The Vagrants, with a character like Bashi, it isn't necessarily communism that causes these characters to do these monstrous acts. I mean, it could very well be some innate quality within, you know, someone like Bashi's character, and it's going to come up irrespective of the ideological system. Similarly, I find this there with the three sworn sisters in Sweeping Past, or to use an even stronger example, in the novella Kindness, Lieutenant Y. I'm wondering, how much have you agonized over this line between what a communist regime forces people to do and what people are already capable of doing?
Right. I think that communism, that system, is always secondary to me, in my view. I think, you know, in a way, characters' fate or people's fate are determined by their personalities, as we always say. And, you know, I think in my stories, you know, rather than stories that take place in America, there's just that one extra hand moving the characters around, which is the Mother of China or Communist Party.
Yeah.
But in a way, I think these characters, especially the characters you mentioned, they already have that in their hearts, in their, you know, in their personality. And if you place them in America or in any other country, they probably would have done the same thing, just with a little bit of variations.
Yeah, that's very true. So it's almost as if this kind of relates to another question I want to ask you. Obviously, you're not living in China right now, and I'm wondering, even if you did write a story based in America, there is one story that in which the early part does take place in America, but for the most part, it's all China. I'm wondering, why not write about, forget America, why not other countries? I mean, do you need that invisible hand, so to speak, to kind of make sure that that these characters are kind of going where they need to go? Or
no, you know, that's a very good question. I actually, more and more, I feel that China is not my only topic, nor is America. I actually feel that the world is becoming smaller, you know, in many ways. Like, people are traveling to other places, and people are reading translations, and people are communicating with other countries. Like, I talked to someone in Spain, and he Skyped with someone in Wisconsin every day, so the guy in Wisconsin could learn Spanish and he could learn English. Yeah. And also, the world is becoming smaller in that way. And also, I feel that's, you know, the global view. But for me as a writer personally, the world is also becoming smaller in that I actually can see other parts better than I when I was younger. So I could very well imagine writing about someone not in America, not in China, somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it's always an alluring to do that, you know, elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if you draw almost from the past. That's interesting to me because a lot of writers draw from the present. Some just make shit up, you know. But it seems to me that, you know, just as you need to have a character without something and this invisible hand, you also need to have this linear creation going on. And I'm wondering why that is. Did you thought about this?
Yes. Or? You know, I actually have thought a lot about that because for me, I think the one thing that is the most important thing in fiction for me is how time passes.
Yeah.
And in the way that I think I write fiction entirely to explore how time passes in a character's life, you know, in a group of characters, in a community, in a country, but it's always about time. And so it's actually very hard for me just to write about the present moment because present moment is full of pasts. You know, if you look at present, there are many, many different past moments condensed in this moment. So that's why I think I always have to have the past.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned this because I wanted to ask you specifically about time in relation to how you juxtapose it. In Kindness, Moyan notes to Lieutenant Y, sought the times during a meal, she would study my face. In A Man Like Him of Teacher Fay, nearly 40 years since last painted out of free will. That's interesting. You need to have a juxtaposition of time, 40 years during a meal, some interval. Why? Does action need to be tied like that for you? Why does it work the best?
Yeah. Because for me, every character lives multiple lives at multiple moments. So say if we sit in a coffee shop now, but there are moments that part of us are living in other moments in the past. So
I'm totally here for you.
Oh, gosh.
just to be clear.
Thank you very much.
I'm totally listening to you.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
Thank you. But in a way, I think in fiction, I think like you dissect a moment, actually dissect that moment to see how time passes even within that moment.
Yeah.
So it's always something that I'm drawn to,
yeah,
to explore.
Do you feel that that's the best way for you to portray the essence of a character to the reader?
Yes, I think so. Yes, because, you know, sometimes people would say, you know, how are you? Meaning, you know, how are you doing? To me, it's more like, where are you? Are you at this moment or another moment? Are you in this place or in another space? So where a character is very important time-wise for me. Yeah.
Well, you established from the get-go, well, we know how these characters are doing, not so well. So I mean, you know, by conveniently starting from places of death and loss, I mean,
that's right.
It should be pretty clear they're not exactly the happiest camper. But this is interesting because I noticed, just in comparing The Vagrants with this book, that in The Vagrants, you know, there's some similes in there. Not so much with these stories. I'm wondering if you're basically getting the weed whacker out and trying to kill all the likes and asses in your stories. Would this be safe to say that you're trying to do a simile crackdown?
A simile crackdown?
A simile crackdown, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I've been noticing that. I mean, there's a few in The Vagrants.
Yeah.
But not so much in this. I was really surprised. I mean, I'm thinking like in The Vagrants, for example, like the chorus at the very beginning that sings as happy as a river, you know, things like that. There's lots of that, but in these stories, I was like, wait, where are the similes? You know,
that's a very interesting thing because I think maybe that's because I as the writer also was at different moments in writing The Vagrants and the stories. I feel maybe when I was writing the stories, I was at a moment that I just wanted to get it to the essence of the story without any extra help. In a way, it was a challenge for myself as a writer, too.
It's part of this matching the music in your head.
Yes.
Huh. Are there sentences in this book that don't match the music in your head?
In the new book? In the collection of stories?
Yeah, and how do you deal with that?
You know, I thought actually the stories in the new collection matched my music better than The Vagrants. not that the Vagrants did not match the music, but because the Vagrants was about a historical period, I actually was listening to a lot of revolutionary songs when I was writing that. So, but those songs were not my natural music. So there was that conflict there.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's why the Vagrants, you know, prose-wise, it was a little bit louder and a little bit different than the stories.
So just to kind of, I mean, I'm really fascinated with this music in your head thing, and I can totally relate to this myself.
Oh, sorry.
No worries.
Yeah.
So when a character comes, when you're trying to match the music in your head, do you see the character dancing to the music?
No. I don't see.
You already know how the character, what the character's going to do, but you need to match the music in order to make that happen.
Right. I think, you know, in a way, cheating way, it's the music, actually, I can hear it. The characters cannot hear it.
Of course, I can't hear it. Right. You know. I'm going to go ahead and try to put something on your head so I can. You could get a MacArthur that way. I don't know.
No, the characters can't hear it either. So in a way, I think they are blind. They're blinded by their fate, but that fate is sort of like the music. Well, I'm aware of that.
You're the intermediary then.
A little bit. Yes.
You've got these characters. They're existing. Then you've got the music, and then you've got the book, or you know, the computer screen. Yeah, that's how it works. Huh. Well, speaking of which, I wanted to also ask, just because I'm fascinated by this question. You know, what's your how does your working relationship differ from editor to editor? Like, if you're working with Bridget Hughes and if you're working with Deborah Treisman, you know, what's the difference? Are you writing any of these stories specifically for these magazines, or do you not care about such distinctions? Or do you know what, say, Deborah or Bridget is going to ask for? That, you know?
Right. No, I don't think about particular editors.
Yeah.
But because I work actually with Cressida.
Yes.
At The New Yorker. So
yes.
Cressida is my main.
Oh,
Cressida,
okay.
Lachan.
Got it.
So what happens, you know, when you work with an editor, I think these editors, you know, Bridget or Cressida, know me really well. They know my work really well. So in a way, I think the working relationship is similar, you know, with either of them, because pretty much they're not, I would say they're asking me questions. For instance, if I turn in a rough draft, they would not say, you know, they would not go onto the line right away. They would just ask me questions about the characters. Sometimes those questions I have never thought about.
Yeah.
Or I have not thought out well. So those are the best editing processes. You know, they make me think. They push me to spend more time with the characters.
They know that if you get extensive line editing, then it's going to be hard to match the music.
Yeah. That's probably true.
Yeah. Have you informed these editors of your music situation?
Have what? Pardon me?
Have you informed them that
this is
the process?
No.
Okay. Well, now they know.
Oh, yes,
they're listening.
There you go.
Why? Are there any editors who really do heavy line editing, and how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, not the editors I work with.
Yeah.
Yes. For instance, you know, like, of course, different editors would do different things. I really like to work with Michael Ray, too, at Zoetrope All Story. And he's a very particular reader. He would notice things like, he said, you have a habit of having these sentence patterns.
Yeah.
And sometimes he would point, the pattern appears 5 times in the paragraph.
Yeah.
And that is very helpful. And right away, I mean, he would not do the line editing. He would point out the patterns, and I would change the pattern a little. So.
There's some wiggle room so you could change it on your own.
Yes.
Yeah, got it.
Yes.
Which, yeah.
That's
sensible editors all, I think.
That's right.
I'm curious, though, how did Souvenir get with the San Francisco Chronicle then? I mean, did they specifically ask you for, like, a sort of sexual embarrassment story?
No. What happened is they're doing, like, the Chronicle has this fiction issue every summer. So I was asked to write a story, and which is difficult to write for a newspaper because they have a 2,000 words limit.
Yeah.
Well, my story usually runs up to 6,000 words.
Yeah.
You know, I write longer stories. So for that story, I struggled a lot. And I thought I would just get to the essence of that story. It's just one encounter in one moment.
Yeah.
But then both characters have a lot of moments, a lot of history. So that's how it it's how it went to San Francisco Chronicle.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, newspapers also have really tough deadlines.
That's right.
Are deadlines ever an issue for you? Or
In general, I work well under deadlines. But again, I just feel, you know, that when you write a story for a newspaper, it's different than when you write a story on your own in a little bit. But I was happy. There are 2 stories in the collection were written for newspapers.
That's right.
The Sweeping Past.
That's right.
That went to The Guardian fiction.
Oh,
issue.
The Guardian, of course. You know, because I don't think of The Guardian as a newspaper because they're a little bit different than like an American newspaper.
Right,
the Chronicle.
That's right.
They're a little bit more free form. And,
right,
you know,
right. But both stories, if you notice, they are shorter than other stories because they were written for newspapers.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to actually ask about one thing. In Kindness, Moya notes that it is our nature to make a heaven out of places to which we never return. I don't think I really quite got an answer on why the past is more of an inspiration point than the present.
Why? Okay. Well, would it be fair to say that my characters are oftentimes living in the past?
Yes. That's a fair answer.
Yes.
But it's just as an author, I mean, are you working with like, you know, a songbook in your head from 20 years ago or...
Well, not really, but I think, or another way to explain is, you know, if you tell me a joke, you know, if you tell a joke to a group of people, everybody would laugh, right? And half an hour later, I would be laughing in the cab. That is like there's a lapse of time for me to understand certain things. So I do think I feel like I need time to process things. And maybe that's why past is also easier for me to write about. Because this present moment, I need at least, you know, another 5 years to process.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it would seem to me that the delayed reaction for you is actually greatly beneficial in coming up with stories that you just need a lot of... I mean, I hate to compare you to a computer, but you need a lot of processing time, basically.
True, I do.
I'm wondering why that is. Do you need to really think every angle out on a story or every angle out on a situation?
I think so. I guess this comes to how one processes about the world. Is like every time I make a conclusion, right away my tendency is to question that conclusion. Then I have to ask more questions to question my questions.
That sounds to me like a scientist.
I did have a scientist background,
so
I think for me it's always that the questioning stage would go on for a while.
Yeah. Does the questioning stage ever drive you nuts? Like, oh God, I wish my mind would just shut up, you know?
Well, sometimes I wish I could just say, yes, this is the truth, but no, I can never say that.
Yeah, so then if there is no absolute truth, what is truth for you? I mean, what is a sort of like answer that would actually satisfy you?
I think it's just that effort, that constant effort to push towards, you know, getting to know the truth. I think that matters to me more than just the truth itself or the center itself.
The journey, not the destination.
Oh, yes.
Because the destination you can pretty much figure out, or at least you already have a few conclusive answers. The question is how one arrives there. That's really the ultimate way to both contemplate existence and chronicle it in fiction?
Yes, I think that's very well said.
Okay. I'll just keep answering your questions. I'm sorry. No, I know that Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, the title story, was written to talk back to William Trevor's three people, and that some passages of The Vagrants were written in response to Graham Greene. I'm wondering how much of this conversation is going on interconnectedly within your work. I ask because there is a Nini within Kindness in Professor Shan's building. And I was like, wait a minute. Could it be? Well, no, it isn't. Sharing the character's name, I don't know. What of this interconnectedness? I mean, are you now at the point where you're kind of having like a big chat room between the stories here?
Well, apparently the two Ninis are two characters, but you know, in a way, Nini in Chinese means little girl.
Yeah.
And both characters have that little girl characteristic in them. So somehow I was very attached to that name.
Yes.
So I would assign that name to a little girl. But do my stories talk to each other? Yes, actually sometimes I do imagine, you know, characters from different stories. You know, what would happen if they run into each other? Would they make each other's lives better or more difficult? I always wonder about that.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because I actually wanted to, let me find out the specific example because Souvenir. In The Vagrants, there's the moment where Tong observes the bored sales assistant who forms a pistol with his hand and aims it at a female colleague's bosom. Now, Souvenir could almost be an expansion of that moment. And I'm wondering if there are specific images from the novel that you rethink or reconsider or approach from a different angle in a short story.
You know, so funny because if you look at The Vagrants, there are a lot of animals in that.
Yes, novel. Yes, there are.
Yes. Somehow I think those animals lived on, in like sort of move into my stories, or maybe they just are always present.
Well, they don't suffer very good fates in The Vagrants, so it makes sense that you would want to redeem them in other...
right. However, I think oftentimes they also meet some terrible things in my stories too. So let me think. I would say this way, you know, The Vagrants, because it's a novel, you know, it has, you know, 60 characters. A lot of times there are quiet moments that I haven't had enough time to develop or to look at. Oh, I can tell you this, like there was one very minor detail in The Vagrants. There were one that when there was the crash down, people started to betray each other.
Yeah.
And there were two young students. They both had a crush on their male teacher. So they were best friends. And they turn each other in to the authority.
Yes.
That was a very minor moment. But I imagine that moment, you know, actually turned into another story in the collection, you know, in a way. I imagine that teacher, I actually imagine that teacher as the same character as the photographer in Sweeping Past. Because he observed these girls, you know, that back and forth.
Yeah. So it seems to me that... Well, is this part of the questioning process? I mean, are you working simultaneously on different stories, or you know, something is germinating right now? Perhaps you know, maybe there's two or three, maybe there's four. I don't know.
Like in general, I keep working. I would have a novel project and a short story going on at the same time. So
there's a natural kind of contrapuntal sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
Yeah. I actually wanted to ask about House Fire because I really got an Alexander McCall Smith vibe from that. And I have to ask, do you read mysteries at all? Or I mean, you know, Graham Greene and The Vagrants is really interesting, but I was like, you know, she's totally reading Alexander McCall Smith. I have to ask.
No, I have not. Huh. I've never.
The Ladies Detective Agency? Number one Ladies Detective Agency? Wow.
No.
Oh, wow, because that's, again, this is what happens with the reader's subconscious association as well. Or
that's
you know,
good.
Well, do you read mysteries at all? Because, I mean, there is often, you know, that same kind of plot and human behavior scenario going off in your fiction.
Well, fiction in general to me is about mystery. So, you know, every story is a detective story in a way. You're trying to get into the heart of the, you know, your character. So, but I don't read a lot of mystery. I read, you know, Patricia Highsmith.
Oh, okay. I knew it. There's had to be something.
Oh, really?
But, you know, Ripley's a really twisted guy.
I know. Yeah. He's one of my favorite characters.
Is this why you were really attracted to perverse and cruel characters? Because it represents some limit of how humans act that is really the best material for fiction? Or?
That's a very good question. I don't know if they just offer the best material or they just offer a more honest picture of human nature, I would say. I think, you know, for instance, Ripley, I mean, he's just a darling character, but terribly, terribly bad, right?
Yeah. But he's so charming.
Right, and
just as Bashy is also very charming, though I'll tell you, I mean, I don't want to give away the book, but the feeling I got from Bashy and The Vagrants was like, God, I really detest this man, and yet I still have some shred of sympathy for him.
Right.
You know, maybe to sort of expand off of the Ripley comparison. Is it kind of a better way for you to avoid, I suppose, the absolute definitions of protagonists and antagonists that just doesn't interest you, and the only way to really just do away with such a binary value is to really kind of explore this dilemma of the charismatic person with lots of perversity and debauchery to boot?
I do. You know, in a way, I think I'm not interested in villains in fiction, and, you know, I'm not interested in the victims either. So if you look at Tom Ripley, he's a villain in a way, but he's not your conventional villain.
Yeah.
And he's in the middle. So I think all my characters, you know, are in the middle, you know, very gray. You can just sort of explore their grayness.
Yeah.
And that's always interesting to me.
What happens if you have a situation where a character just doesn't feel true or doesn't actually examine those gray areas. Have you had situations like this recently at all, or does the thinking process kind of do away with that?
Yes. So there's one character in The Vagrant who actually was very hard for me to write, was, gosh, I forgot her name, the second woman who was executed.
Oh, the wife, the broadcaster.
The broadcaster.
And I'm blanking out the name too.
You, I forgot.
Han.
No, not Han. Han is the husband, yes.
Han's wife. Neither of us can remember.
Yes, so she, in the first draft, she was very difficult because she was a heroine. She actually was a beautiful character.
Yeah.
She had a beautiful face. She had a beautiful voice.
Yeah.
She had a very, you know, glorious, you know, life, which I just, she just came, the first draft, I just thought, I wasn't interested in writing her because she came a little flat for me.
Yeah.
So I thought, where is her grayness? I mean, in the end, I actually thought her marriage was interesting because she had a husband who admired her, you know, who adored her.
Yeah.
But she couldn't.
Too much, though.
I know. She wasn't able to return that, you know, affection, of course. And also her relationship with her child. She tried very hard to be the mother.
Yeah.
But then she noticed that the nanny knew something that she did not know about the child. And that, to me, was the human part of the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, really, it just did it take getting her involved with the anti-revolutionaries to make her interesting? What was it that kind of tipped her out of the sort of boring golden mode?
I know. I think the first draft, she was a little boring to me.
Yeah.
And the second draft, you know, one was her family situation. I wrote a lot about that. Actually, you know, the second draft I wrote pretty much just about her. I added 100 pages about her and then started cutting,
which
is good.
How much do you cut in the revision process?
Well, the original draft was about 500 pages.
Oh, wow.
And then I added 100 pages on this one character. But it's good. You have a lot. And also just her communication with the guy, with Jialin, who had TB.
Yeah.
And that, to me, also was a very humane moment for this character. Is, you know, she had a little bit crush on him, but it was also so because he was so sick.
Yeah.
So that, to me, I think that came in the second draft.
I wanted to go back to the question of the animals and why so many were maimed during the course of the production of The Vagrants.
I think, you know, in a way, that was the historical period. One, you know, if human rights, you know, animal rights and human rights oftentimes are about the same thing, about other lives.
Yeah.
And it was true to that moment that animals oftentimes were horribly treated. And and also just that's human nature. If you can treat a dog or a cat or, you know, hedgehog in a cruel way, it doesn't take a lot to cross the line to treat your fellow human being in that way too. So,
yeah.
So yes.
Well, I mean, this also leads me to wonder, I mean, when you devise a story about China, do you do any research into absolute atrocities, or is this all coming from your memory, or how much of this do you invent? And I'm wondering if that's really fair to the historical record, or does that even matter because, well, this is fiction?
Well, you know, really, it doesn't matter because it's fiction. But on the other hand, these things really just, they were so prevalent that they actually just came from real life, and it was quite easy to live that from reality.
Yeah, yeah. But do you ever adapt things from reality that you've experienced? I mean, to what degree do you do that, particularly in relation to, you know, atrocities along these lines?
So funny, because I actually had someone complain to me about the dog in The Vagrants.
Oh, yeah?
He said, this is actually another immigrant writer. He said, well, I just have to warn you. You know, all these atrocities happen to your characters would not turn off your American readers, but this dog would turn away a lot of readers from you. And I thought it was a very interesting comment.
Yeah.
But atrocities, actually, you know, The Vagrants was still, I would say, you know, there were portrays of atrocities, but they were minimum, I would say.
Yeah.
Because that's not my interest to do that.
Yeah.
Realistic, you know, portrayal.
How concerned are you about getting the reader on board for a story?
I'm not very concerned, because if they are your right readers, they're with you. So if I start to think about how to engage the readers, you know, then then, you know, I think you're taking too many things that they distract you. You're taking too many things into consideration, and they sort of distract you. They're like noises. At while you're writing, you have to stay pure to that music.
Yeah. So the music is actually kind of beneficial because it insulates you from any potential influence, like, oh, Ian, that story sucks, or that idea isn't very good, things like that.
Right. It helps a lot.
Huh. So, I mean, this leads me to wonder, I mean, we were talking a little bit about editors earlier, but when you need to have people look at your story, I mean, how close does that thing have to be done? How close does that have to be set to the music or locked before, you know, you're in a position where, like, okay, I can see where they're coming from and all that. I mean, if there's such an insulation process, what do you do when it actually has to be released?
I know, you know, it's always a problem when you release the story, even to your first reader.
Yeah.
You always wonder, is this right? But I think I get it down as close as I can to that music, and then I would show my first reader, which is, you know, who's Bridget Hughes, and she would read my stuff, and I think oftentimes the music is right, but there are always things that go wrong that she would point out, and I would go back.
So you definitely get the music right, but then some of the situations or some of the characters aren't quite...
Right.
So for you, it's really the sentence that comes before the narrative. Almost.
In a way, yes.
Or
that music comes before anything else.
Yeah.
And once you get that music down, and the sentences, you know, don't change that much. I think oftentimes it's a rearrangement of material, you know, or situations, or adding certain, you know, sentences to make it, I don't know, just closer to that. But I think the music is always there when I get the work done. So that's not something the editor can do, I think.
Does the music apply to other things beyond fiction, like, you know, making a dinner for the family or something?
No, only fiction.
Only fiction,
yes.
Wow. And how long have you had the music playing in your head?
I think pretty much always, you know, since I have started writing. I think since I started writing, it's always that music that is very important to me.
Dickens crops up in the first story and the last story. This leads me to ask, because you do sometimes have these very crunchy modifiers, like chicken clawed hands in The Vagrants and in the story in this, for example. I'm curious about why Dickens shows up in both of those stories, and probably because it's the only thing available, I would just presume. And second, you know, are you not fond of D.H. Lawrence either? I was curious.
Well, you certainly can see the influence from D.H. Lawrence in these stories, right? Or Thomas Hardy.
Yeah.
I think Dickens is interesting. I mean, partly because he was available to the Chinese readers, in the stories.
Yeah.
And partly because he's such a different writer from me, but I learned so much from him, and I always just, you know, it's always interesting because his music, if he has a music, if he is completely different from my music.
Yeah.
I like that.
Huh. Is that how you teach too? Just essentially encouraging people to follow their music? I mean, that seems to be at odds among some MFA types who, I mean, is finding one's individual music compatible with a workshop mode?
No, I don't do that because that would be a little bit too much.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Also, again, that those kind of things you cannot really explain well in the classroom. So in the classroom, I'm rather more conventional than that, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, what's it like for you?
I do advise my students to find, you know, writers, like, they want to talk to.
Yeah.
In their work, like William Trevor for me, I talked to William Trevor, so I encourage my students to read a lot of writers and find that one writer they want to talk to in their work.
Yeah. Is it possible to have too many people, too many writers to talk back to? Or?
Well, once in a while, yes. Yeah. I think Dickens and Tolstoy sometimes talk to me in a very unbeneficial way.
Like how exactly?
Well, Tolstoy is just too articulate. I mean, both of them were too articulate for me. So,
well, Dickens wrote for the word count. You know, he had to get to survive. You know.
So in a way, I think that sometimes bothered me a little because I cannot be as articulate as they are. And but that's okay. Yeah.
Are there any minimalist writers that you have to talk back to? I'm curious.
That's
Dickens and Tolstoy are really expensive.
I know.
Trevor to some degree too. Yeah.
Trevor is not that expensive. No,
yeah.
No, I think the writers I talk to oftentimes are worthier than I am, except for Trevor. I think he is probably at the same level of worthiness as I am. But I like to talk to worthier people, you know, writers, because they talk more, so I can listen.
Or they talk more and you can kind of get the necessary bits from what they're saying.
That's exactly right.
Just one last question. Prison is driven by comparisons rooted around ignorance. Yilin heard a small voice from Fu Sang's bedroom singing folk songs in a dialect that Yilin did not understand. Or the price paid for being a mother, the love of one's own child made everyone else potential enemy. Just to kind of go back to this interesting process you have of just really working out that journey, I'm wondering when such comparisons come, when you're thinking about the ethical ramifications, or is it in the act of writing the story?
Ah, I think it's, you know, it's in the act of writing the story.
Yeah.
I can't, you know.
Yeah, so really it comes down to just working it out on the keyboard, and that's the only way to
I think so.
Really align it. Okay.
Right, you just have to get that sentence there, you know, in a way. I think it's just, sometimes it takes a few trials, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you don't go for walks to sort of think about what you've written or what you're about to write about. What do you do to prepare for something like that?
I do think about the characters, but I don't think in sentences when
I take
a walk. So I mostly think about the characters, how they feel or, you know, what they're doing. So mostly what I think on my walk doesn't get into the fiction, because when you really write it sentence by sentence.
So when do you stop at the end of the day if it's all about the sentences?
Well, with sentences, you get something that you want to say, or you get something that you want to communicate with your readers, and you get them out there, so that's good.
but you strike me as someone who probably can't leave the computer with a half-finished sentence,
no,
like some writers
can.
Oh, yeah.
Hemingway, no, I would never do that.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. What happens if you have a situation where you're spending, like, almost 2 hours trying to get a sentence right?
Oh, that often happens.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Do people check on you and knock on the door and say, Ian, it's time to go and get something to eat or something like that? Or anything like that?
I try not to.
You don't try not to announce that you're there?
No.
Okay.
No, yeah. But I do spend, you know, hours fixing one sentence again and again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. But are some sentences unfixable?
Yes.
What do you do then?
You delete them.
Delete them. Okay. So you do, there's always an out there.
Well, you can always be an eraser if you're not a writer,
right? Got it. On that natural terminal note, Ian, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I look forward to reading more of your stuff.
Thank you very much, Ed.